To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And there we like to look at the words, precisely how we have recovered. If you'll notice, that's in italics. In the first edition, some of those things that's in italics was in big bold letters. And I guess later on they decided it would look better in italics. I call it squiggly writing. And when you see squiggly writing in the big book, it's usually pretty important. It's a point that's very important. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, Joe and I have been around AA long enough to know and fully understand you can't make anybody in AA do anything they don't want to do. And we know and fully understand that the only requirement for membership and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. You know, you can come to an AA meeting, you can stand up in the middle of the meeting and say, I don't like you suckers at all. I nearly vomit when I read you 12 steps, and I can hardly drink your lousy old coffee. But I'm going to be a member of AA because I've got a desire to stop drinking, and nobody can say a word about that. You don't even have to be sober to be a member of AA. It helps if you are, but you don't really have to be a member of AA. But those all deal with requirements for membership and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fellowship. This book has nothing to do with that. This book deals with one thing and one thing only. How do you recover from a hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism? And the main purpose of this book is to show other alcoholics precisely how the first 100 recovered. Later on, we're going to see words like specifically and words like clear-cut directions. You see, we're not going to deal with generalities. It's kind of like making cake. Let's say we go to a good old AA potluck meeting and you show up there with a strawberry cake, which happens to be my favorite. I tell you that just in case we ever go to one together. That's my strawberry. And I get me a piece of that cake and I bite into it, and it's just perfect. The moisture's right, the taste is right, the texture's right, and I say, who made this cake? Well, you'll probably say I made it. And I said, well, will you tell me how? And you say, sure, I'll be glad to. And you sit down and you write out for me a precise set of directions on how to make that cake. You tell me the ingredients to put in it, the quantity of the ingredients, the sequence in which to mix them together, the temperature at which to bake it, and how long to bake it. Now, if I take your directions in my kitchen and I follow them precisely as you've laid them out, when that thing comes out of the oven, cools off, and I bite into it, I think I can expect it to taste exactly like your cake tasted. But if I get your directions in my kitchen and my keen intellectual alcoholic mind begins to work, it may say, well, no, I'm not sure about this 3 cups of sugar. You know, maybe we ought to have 4.5 cups. Or I'm not sure about 4 eggs. Maybe I'll just have 2 eggs. I'm not sure whether I ought to bake it 18 minutes or 25. Should I really bake it at 375 or how about 450? When that sucker comes out of the oven and cools off and I bite into it, well, I'm going to be biting into a piece of cake. But I wonder how closely it would resemble your cake, which was my reason for making it in the first place. A precise, specific, clear-cut set of directions on how to recover from alcoholism.
Right.
And those of us today who follow them, I think we can expect to get what they got, recovery from alcoholism, not just sobriety. You see, as we begin to lay the book down, we begin to stay sober on fellowship. Then we begin to change from a quality, life-changing program to a non-drinking program. And the whole thrust of AA started changing. And today it's based on how long you've been sober. I'm not concerned how long I've been sober. I'm concerned on the quality of my sobriety so I don't have to drink tomorrow. And that's what the book deals with, is quality of sobriety. Joe?
Okay. This brings us to the doctor's opinion, and we're going to begin on XXIV. We're going to begin with Dr. Silkworth, and Dr. Silkworth is the person, the individual who's credited with giving Bill and giving it to us the information to discover the problem. What is the problem? What is the problem of alcoholism? Now, as John said, this was an elusive thing that men have sought for many years. You know, it's very, if we look at the, look up the Silkworth's time in the beginning of AA, we had a problem in our world that we never understood. Right today, we have health problems. We have AIDS, cancer, major health problems. And we say we're hunting for a cure. We're hunting for a solution to these problems. But we're spending money on research. And the research is directed to find out what is the problem. If we knew how these things were, if we knew where they existed and what caused them, then we could develop something to counteract them or a solution. Same way about the alcoholic. You know, since the beginning of time, as people begin to drink, as John said, certain people had problems with alcohol. Now, what happened was the people who didn't have a problem, the social drinkers, the non-alcoholic people,
or the non-drinkers,
trying to find out what was wrong with the alcoholic. All the ignorance and misunderstandings have been developed about the non-alcoholic toward the alcoholic. You know, you can go all the way back in history, and there are many, many, and through history, as John said, in one of my, in the big, big book in the Bible, there's many, it's an earlier recording of human history. And in there, it's many times it talks about this problem. Solomon, whose credit was writing Proverbs, a man of great wisdom, had great interest in the human nature and human problems. People came to him from all over his known world for answers. He was a social worker of his day. He looked into social human problems. And somebody asked him about, look seemingly about one of us. And he said, who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who has redness of eyes? Who has wounds without cause? And he said, they that tarry long at the wine.
Everybody was a wino in those days.
Yeah, see, we didn't have no beer and whiskey. Everybody was a wino in those days. And he went on to talk about the things that happen to us. He said, you will be as one who lies down in the midst of a sea. You know, you sway around a lot.
Remember how that old bed used to move when you'd lay down in it?
Or sleepeth on the top of a mast. You know, the mast the ship tossed. And he said, you will say they have beaten me, and I felt it not. And he sure knew some of us fellows, because he said, thine eyes shall behold strange women.
You see, alcoholics really haven't changed. They're the same today as they always been.
And thy heart shall utter perverse things. You know, you say a lot of things you don't want to say. But we baffled Solomon because after all these things he observed, he was mystified by the alcoholic. All human beings were, no one ever understood it. Because the way he closed his statement out, he said, but still yet they rise in the morning and they seek it yet again. We baffled Solomon. We baffled all the great minds of the world. No one understood the problem, but everybody tried the solution. You know what I mean? They said it was a sin. They said it was a weakness. You know, 1784, Dr. Rush said it was a disease. No one listened to him. You know what I mean? We went through Prohibition. They didn't understand the problem, but the solution was we can laugh. We can, people be laughing at us. We can laugh at people in history, the mistakes they make. You know, we don't know anything about the alcoholism, but we'll vote out the alcohol. That'll get rid of it. But that didn't work either. So it was in 19, of all places, the Towns Hospital, a little drying out place that Charlie Towns run. For people, that's where Bill went. That's where people went to have the ability to pay. Dr. Silkworth went to work there in 1930. Dr. Silkworth was a urologist. He wasn't, this wasn't really his field. It wasn't his interest. But he had lost his money in the stock market crash. It was during depression. He couldn't get a job, so he took a job there working in this little drying out place for Chinatown. $40 a week, room and board. And it was there that, you know, he was a real doctor. and he became interested in his patience, and he began to study, even though people said it was a weakness of sin, he began to get some insights into this. He began to say that, I think it's his forces within these people, and he was able to divide this force into two parts. He said this helped him. He said, I believe part of it is in the body and part of it is in the mind. And he began to say that he didn't know exactly what was going on in the body, but he knew there was some abnormal thing taking place in the alcoholic. So he said, I don't have the knowledge, I don't have the ability, we don't have the ability to understand this today. He said, I know an allergy is not a complete explanation of the problem, but for the best right now, all I can say is there's something abnormal going on, so I'm going to say it's an allergy. And he came up with these the concept of the mind and these two things, and he developed this little theory, and he shared it from 1930 to 1933, and he shared it with Bill 3 years later. And based on this, Bill applied the solution, and he found his recovery, and this beginning of a little chain reaction of 100 people. Now, this book was published in 1939, and we know it was reviewed by the American Medical Association pretty critically. They said it had no medical value whatsoever. But based on this little theory put into practice by the first 100, 150,000 people got sober by 1956. After 150,000 people got sober, then American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association agreed that alcoholism was a disease. And today, you know, this is, but beginning from the big book, it began with Dr. Silkworth. He was a person that, he's a father of the whole field, because he was a person that discovered the real problem of alcoholism. And it's still in the book the way he wrote it. He didn't say, I made a great discovery. He just said, this is my opinion. And this opinion has become a fact today. So it's just as here, the same way Dr. Silkworth wrote it in the publishing of the book.
Now, one statement I hear around AA today, which definitely came from the treatment center field.
Yeah.
They say this is a disease of denial. I don't think it is. This is an illness of ignorance.
That's right.
Before we get here, before we get into the big book, we are out there as practicing alcoholics. We don't have any idea what's wrong with us. We think it's willpower. We think it's moral character. We think it's sin. We think it's just a dirty, rotten, no good SOB. Why would we not think that? That's what everybody told us. You can't deny something that you don't know.
No.
Now, after we go through the doctor's opinion and find out what the problem really is, then if we say we don't have it, then we're denying the fact.
That's right.
But until we see this information, yeah, it's an illness of ignorance.
That's right.
We simply don't know what's wrong with us. I was absolutely amazed to see this information. Did John talk any this afternoon about taking the doctor's opinion from page one and putting it back in the Roman numerals?
I don't think so.
In the first edition of the book,
yeah,
page one started with the doctor's opinion.
Yeah.
Bill's story, chapter one, started with page 10.
Yeah.
And everybody that went to the book opened it to page one and read the doctor's opinion. Now, when it came out with the second edition, and nobody really knows why, Bill was alive when they did it too, they came out with the second edition, they took the doctor's opinion,
moved it up,
and put it in the Roman numerals, and put Bill's story, chapter 1, page 1. Maybe they thought that looked better, I don't know. But what happened when they did that? People quit reading the doctor's opinion.
Nobody reads.
Hell, nobody reads the Roman numerals in a book. You always go to page 1, and people quit reading the doctor's opinion.
That's right.
Not too long ago, back in our area, we had a young fellow that had been through a big book study, had been studying the book. He made a little talk at an AA meeting, and he talked about the doctor's opinion, the physical allergy, and the obsession of the mind. And after he was through, one of the older members came up to him and said, young man, the information you presented was great, but we don't believe in talking about anything in AA except conference-approved material.
He had never read it.
Hell, he had never read the doctor's opinion. He'd been sober about 12 years. It's amazing how many people in AA today haven't read it. Let's look at it for a little bit.
Okay, now we know that's step one is a foundation. A doctor's opinion, to me, is a foundation of the book. It's, I think it ought to be reported, the contents of the book. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind.
Now, this is the first time we can find anywhere in written history a reference to the fact that the body is affected as well as the mind.
Yeah.
Everything up until this time had dealt with the mind only. Mm-hmm. But here we see a statement that says the body is quite as abnormal as the mind. I think he's saying two things. First, the body's included in this deal too. Second, both the body and the mind are abnormal when it comes to alcohol. We react to it different physically. We also react to it different mentally. We'll talk about both of those in just a little bit.
It did not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies are sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out his physical factor is incomplete. So we're going to look at the body and the mind. The body is included. It's the first time in history. You know, they always, they said up to this point, it was weak will. It was, you know, you were crazy or you were sinful. Things of the mind. It was all seemed to, they thought, took place in the mind. But Dr. Silkworth says, no, the body is included too. Part of it's in the body and part of it's in the mind. First time the body was mentioned in the problem of alcoholism. The doctor's theory is that we have an allergy interest us. As laymen, our opinions to the soundest may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things which would not otherwise account. And now we see this word, allergy.
Now, if the purpose of a textbook is to transfer information from the mind of one human being through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book, and I think that's what they're for, then it stands to reason that the transfer of that information is going to be based upon the understanding of the words that are used. If the writer of the book uses a word and has a certain understanding of it, the reader of the book reads that word but has a different understanding, then the information that comes through is going to be garbled and incomplete information. And there seems to be a few key words in the big book that we've had a lot of difficulty with. And one of them, I think, is this word allergy. You know, most of us, before we get here, we assume that we know what an allergy is. I know that I assumed it. And I knew that if you were allergic to something and you got around it, ate it, drank it, or whatever, there would be some physical manifestation that you could see. For instance, if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat them, you'll have a rash, and the rash is the physical manifestation of that allergy. If you're allergic to milk and you drink it, you'll have a bad case of dysentery, the dysentery being the physical manifestation of that allergy. If you're allergic to ragweeds, various other plants, and you get around them, your eyes itch, your nose itch, they water, you begin to sneeze. The itchy, watery eyes, nose, and sneezing, that's the physical manifestations of that allergy, and they're very easy to spot. Now, I come to AA, and they said to me, Charlie, you have an allergy to alcohol, and you'll never be able to safely drink it again. And I thought a moment, and I said, now, how can I be allergic to alcohol? Now, I'm drinking a quart a day. You know, how can you possibly be allergic to it and drink that much of it? And I said, besides that, when I drink alcohol, I don't break out in a rash. I don't always have a bad case of dysentery. Once in a while I would, depending on what I've been drinking, but usually I didn't. Nor did it make my eyes, nose itch, water, and cause me to sneeze. And I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. You didn't explain that to me. And they said, well, you don't need to understand it. They said, all you need to know is you can't drink, period. Well, today I think I know why they told me that. I don't think they understood it a bit better than I did. Now, if you've got a keen intellectual alcoholic mind like I've got, and you get a question like that dangling out here in front of you, it's going to run you out of your mind sooner or later. And I would go from person to person to person to person. This is the days when I first started trying to study the book. And they'd say, ah, forget it. You know, what difference does it make whether you're allergic or not? Hell, just don't drink. You'll be all right. And nobody could ever give me an explanation. And finally, one day I went to a source of information that's never failed me since that time. I went to a dictionary. I didn't want to, but I did. And I looked up the word allergy. And I found several definitions, the same as you do for any word, depending on how it's used. But I found the one I think fits me exactly. And it said an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance of any kind. An abnormal reaction. So I began to look back in my drinking career to see where I was abnormal. And you know, I was absolutely amazed to realize that I don't know what's normal and what's abnormal. The only thing I knew about drinking is the way I drank and the way those people drank who drank with me. And if they didn't drink like I did, we didn't drink together. So I've got to go talk to the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker and have them describe to me how they feel whenever they drink alcohol. What's their reaction? And usually I get an answer like this. Well, we can come home from work, tired, tense, wrought up from the day's work, have a drink or two before dinner, get a relaxing feeling, go ahead and have dinner, and then we probably won't drink anymore that night. Well, now I don't feel that way when I drink. When I take a drink of alcohol, as I put it to my mouth and it crosses my lips begin to tingle immediately. Hits my teeth and they kind of chatter up and down. Strikes my tongue and I can feel it immediately begin to grow and expand and swell. Hits my cheeks and they kind of flutter in and out. I feel it passing through my sinus cavities up into my forehead, and I begin to get a feeling in my forehead which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. And I haven't even swallowed the damn stuff yet. I just got it in my mouth. When I swallow it and it starts down through my esophagus, great things start taking place. I feel my chest begin to grow and expand and get bigger and better. Hits my stomach, just literally explodes like a bomb. I feel it racing through my arms. They get longer and longer. Hits my hands and fingers and they begin to tingle and vibrate. At the same time, it's racing through my arms, it's racing through my legs. They're getting longer and longer. I'm getting taller and taller. And it hits my feet and toes, and they get a hot, intense, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. I don't understand a relaxing feeling when you have a drink. Entirely different. Those people continued to tell me some things which absolutely blew my mind. They said, Charlie, whenever we have a couple of drinks, they said we begin to get a slightly tipsy, out of control feeling. And they said, we don't like that feeling. Therefore, one or two drinks is all we want to drink. Today I realize that's the normal reaction to alcohol. For most people, alcohol is a sedative, it's a downer. And they take a couple of drinks, it goes to the stomach, immediately into the bloodstream, immediately to the brain, and it is supposed to sedate the brain and give you a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. But that doesn't happen to me. When it goes in my stomach and hits the bloodstream and goes to the brain, instead of me getting a slightly tipsy, out-of-control up here in my head, I get a very exciting, in-control feeling. Hell, they have two drinks, they want to go to bed. I have two drinks, I want to go to town. I want to do an entirely different mental reaction. Now they also say to me, and this is the one that really blew my mind. They said after we've had a couple of drinks, not only do we get the slightly tipsy, out of control feeling, but we begin to experience a feeling of nausea. And they said, we don't like that feeling. Therefore, one or two drinks is all we want to take. How many times have you and I tried to get them to drink more than a couple? They say, oh, no, I feel this already. Or, no, this is making me dizzy. Or, no, it's making me sick. That's the way you're supposed to react to alcohol. It's a destroyer of human tissue. When you put something in the body, it's going to destroy it. The mind and body will normally react with nausea and say, let's vomit it up and get it out of here before it hurts us. But you put it in my body, and my body doesn't react with nausea. My body reacts with this actual physical craving that demands more of the same. Their body says, puke it up. Mine says, put some more in. And that craving is so strong that after I once start, it overcomes the ability of the mind to control the amount that I'm going to take, and I end up drunk every time. So I react abnormally to alcohol two ways. First, mentally. For them, it's a downer. For me, it's a stimulant. Now, later on, after 20 drinks, it becomes a downer. But the first two drinks for an alcoholic is a stimulant. So I react different mentally, and I also react different physically. Their body says, puke it up. Mine says, put some more in. You can't see my allergy to alcohol. You can see that one to strawberries. That's a rash. You can see that one to milk. That's dysentery. You can see that one to ragweeds. That's itchy, watery eyes and sneezing. You can't see mine. You can only feel it. And only alcoholics feel it. Normal drinkers never feel this great, exciting, in-control feeling, nor do they ever feel the physical craving that's developed after we put it in our body. They'll never understand us any more than I'll ever understand their feelings. See? I just can't imagine somebody taking two drinks and saying, well, I believe I'll go to sleep. I just can't imagine that.
That's true. We'll never understand them, and, you know, they will never understand us. They always say, why don't you just take two and stop? You know what I mean? That's okay for them. You know, I, Charlie and I, over the years, I've become a great student of social drinkers, non-alcoholic people. I love to, it just amazes me to watch them drink. The best place to watch them is on the airplanes while you got them in close. You know, you can watch them. And as soon as they get up in the air, you know, they come around that little cart, and they give them little ridiculous bottles. You know, an ounce. That ain't even. Oh my God! And they get those little bottles, and they pour it up in their cups, and then they got some sort of ceremony. They got them little sticks. They stir a lot. You know, they stir. I don't know what they're doing. I never did stir. You know. And when they get it all stirred up, you know what they do? They set it down and read the damn magazine. And I'll be saying, Jenga, what are you doing? You know, it's really. And, you know, they'll mess around there for about an hour, you know. And sometimes they leave it. Sometimes they say, give me some more peanuts. I never did need no peanuts. What are you. We had one guy on the plane one time. He poured half of it. He was neat. He was real neat. He'd hold up the sun so he could see it. And he poured half of it in his glass. Put the little top on and put it back in his pocket. Boy, it was amazing. We were shocked. We got off the plane. Charlie saw him in the aisle and asked him, what are you going to do with that, what you put in your pocket? He said, I'm going to fix me another drink when I get home, right? Now, they call that normal. I call that sick. That's sick drinking.
If there's any such thing as alcohol abuse, I think that's it right there.
But that's normal, see? You can see what I'm talking about. How normal, you know, they don't understand. Our drinking looks just as funny as their drinking looks to us. Right? Yeah, I was sitting in the bar when I sobered up. I had the only job I could find, and waiting tables. But this is when I began to watch social drinkers. As I was sobering up, and I would watch these people come in, watch them drink, and I would study these social drinkers. This one guy come up to the bar one night. I was having a Christmas party, and I was mixing drinks, and he come up and he shocked me. He said, "Joe, give me another drink. I lost my drink." I said, you did what? He said, I lost my drink. Now, I shocked me. Now, I lost my car, but I never did lose a drink. See, they lose drinks, we lose cars, you know.
Abnormal reaction. Now, a good textbook.
Yeah.
Never tells you anything, but what it doesn't give you additional
That's
information
right.
to back up what it's just told you.
Okay.
Now, he told us here about the abnormal reaction or the physical side. Let's go over to Roman numeral 20.
Yeah.
Roman numeral 26.
26.
First paragraph, and here he says,
"We believe,
and so suggested a few years ago, the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed a habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile upon them and become astonishingly difficult to solve." Now, I think what he said is this. You know, the action of strawberries on one who is allergic to strawberries is manifested by the rash. The action of milk on one who's allergic to milk is manifested by the dysentery. The action of ragweeds on one who's allergic to ragweeds is manifested by the itchy, watery eyes and the sneezing. Now, the action of alcohol on one who's allergic to alcohol is manifested by, and here he calls it, the phenomenon of craving. Now, he uses the word phenomenon to indicate that he doesn't understand it. So we can say the real action of alcohol on those who are allergic to alcohol is manifested by the craving in the body, which is misunderstood by Dr. Silkworth. But it's an actual physical craving, and it comes only after we have had a drink. Just like the reaction to strawberries comes only after eating strawberries. To milk, it's only after drinking milk. To ragweeds, it's only after So, the physical craving in the body is our manifestation of that allergy. And it happens after we've had a drink. Now, the word craving is very, very important. People many times will say, well, I came to AA and I craved a drink for 4 years. No, in the context of the big book, that's the wrong use of that word. They may have wanted a drink, needed a drink, desired a drink, but the only way an alcoholic can crave alcohol is to first put it in the system. Then the physical allergy takes over. The phenomenon of craving develops, and then we can't stop. And any time you see the word craving in the big book, it's always referring to the body, not to the mind. It's very important we understand that. If not, we really get confused as to what the allergy is. Now, he's going to continue this on Roman numeral 28 by talking about five different kinds of alcoholics and then making this same point all over again.
Okay, 28. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. And then he's going to talk about the different types of alcoholics. He's going to mention some of them. The book is not going to include all of them, but here's just some of them. There are, of course, psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They are always going on a wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
We call that type one.
Then he says, there is a type of man who's unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment.
Type two.
There is a type who always believes that to be entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, they can take a drink without danger.
Type three.
There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom the whole chapter could be written.
Type four. Now, I always thought I was the next one, a type 5.
Charlie likes to be a 5. He thinks he's a 5. Then there are types that are entirely normal in every respect except the effect alcohol has upon them.
This is the part I really like here.
They're often able, intelligent, friendly people. He likes that.
I used to read that and I'd say, I wonder how he knew so much about me anyhow. Now he makes his point.
Okay.
All these and many others have one symptom in common.
One.
They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. I think what he said is this, that if all we alcoholics in this room this evening should take a drink, God forbid that happen, but if we did, we wouldn't all react exactly the same. In just a minute, one of us would be crying in our beer, oh, boo-hoo-hoo, the world's not treating me right. Just a little bit, one of us will be right up on and cutting up and having a hell of a good time. In just a little bit, there'll be two of us in the corner back there where Pete is, getting in a fight as sure as anything. In just a little bit, there'll be a couple in this corner, one putting the make on the other. We tend to do that also when we drink. We would do many different things. But if we're real alcoholic, there's one thing every one of us would do. We would start looking for a second drink. The phenomenon of craving has developed. The allergy has now taken over, and we can't stop. We'll have to have a third drink, and a fourth drink, and a fifth drink, and a sixth drink, and on till we're drunk, sick, and in all kinds of trouble. Now, it really doesn't make any difference whether we're born with that or whether we drink ourselves into it. The fact remains, that's the way we are today. And I know that's the way we are today, because if we were not that way today, we wouldn't be in this room today. If you and I could drink without developing the phenomenon of craving, you know where we'd be? Well, we'd be out there at a bar somewhere drinking. Because you see, we can't do that. We found that out. Nor does it make any difference how long it takes us to get drunk. You know, this thing had become so pronounced in me before I got through with drinking, that if I'd take a drink right now at 5 after 5, I'll guarantee you by 8 o'clock I found a policeman and I'm in jail somewhere. Some of you might have one or two tonight, 3 or 4 tomorrow night, 4 or 5 the next night. And it may take you a week to find your policeman and go to jail, but what difference does it make? The first drink is the one that triggers it. That was given to us by Dr. Silkworth. Now in the 1930s they knew very, very little about metabolism. And all the doctor could say is, I see that happening, but I don't understand it. Today they understand it. Today they know if you and I put anything into the system, such as a piece of beefsteak, the mind and body will recognize it immediately. Certain organs of the body will start producing some things called enzymes. The enzymes will attack the beefsteak, break it down, separate it into usable and non-usable items. The proteins, the amino acids, the vitamins, the things that the body needs, it will retain. What it can't use, it'll dissipate through the urinary and intestinal tract. That's called metabolism. It'll do it with a liquid just like it does it with a solid. We want to look at a little picture for just a moment. Now, let us be the first to say that this is not AA information. Joe, where's my picture? You don't know? Well, I don't either. Here it is. Let us be the first to say this is not AA information. AA doesn't get involved in this. AA just says we got an allergy and they leave it at that because they don't want any controversy. But the medical profession today has pretty well proven the doctor's opinion. And we've looked at study after study after study after study, and they all show basically the same thing. The center line here represents the 9 people who can drink safely or they are at ease with alcohol. They take a drink, they put it in the system, the mind and body recognize it, the enzyme production starts. The enzymes attack the alcohol, break it down to material known as acetaldehyde. Then after a while it becomes diacetic acid. Then after a while it becomes acetone. In the final stages, it becomes a simple carbohydrate made up of water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. The water will be dissipated through the urinary and intestinal tract. The sugar is pure energy, calories, empty calories, none of the amino acids, none of the vitamins, but a form of energy. The body will burn it as energy, store the excess of fat to be used at a later date. The carbon dioxide will be dissipated through the lungs. Now, in the normal social drinker, this metabolic rate is approximately 1 ounce per hour. Now, I know it'll vary with different people, but approximately 1 ounce per hour. If they don't drink more than that, they can't get drunk. And very seldom do they drink more than that. Remember, they get the slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling they don't like. They get the nauseous feeling. And if you're with one of them and they're drinking more than an ounce per hour, you better stand to the side, because they're going to puke on you after a while. It's going to come out. Let's take now the one on the left-hand side of the sheet. The one who does not drink safely. The one who is at disease. Now, we got all kinds of problems with this word disease, but all it simply means is something that separates you from the norm.
Yes.
One person out of 10 takes a drink. The same thing starts. The mind and body recognizes it. The enzyme production starts, attacks it, breaks it down to acetaldehyde, then to diacetic acid, then to acetone. Now, it seems as though in the body of the alcoholic, the enzymes necessary to metabolize it from acetone to the simple carbohydrate are not there in the same qualities and or quantities as they are in the body of the non-alcoholic. And it stays in the body of the alcoholic for a much longer period of time as acetone. Maybe we're metabolizing 3/4 of an ounce, 1/2 ounce, 1/4 ounce, 1/10 ounce. It'll vary with different alcoholics. Today they have proven that acetone ingested into the human system that remains there for an appreciable period of time will produce an actual physical craving for more of the same. In the non-alcoholic, it goes through that stage so rapidly that the craving never occurs. In the body of the alcoholic, it stays there long enough, it produces the physical craving, and then that physical craving demands a second drink. Now we take a second drink. We've got most of the acetone from the first still in the body. We put in the acetone from the second one, and the acetone level goes up. And when it goes up, the craving becomes harder, and that demands a third drink. We take the third drink, we got most of the first, nearly all the second, now then we put in the acetone from the third, the acetone level goes up, and the craving becomes harder. Each drink we take, the harder we crave the next one. Until at midnight, we're laying out in the parking lot, they run over us and broke her leg, and they come running up to us and say, "Can we help you?" And we say, "My God, yes, give me another drink." See, we're craving it harder at midnight after 20 drinks than we did at 6 in the evening after 2 drinks. There's never enough. I drank 26 years. I don't ever remember drinking all the alcohol that I wanted. Now, I drank more than I needed 1,001 times, but I never got all the way. Hell, I could be on the floor sick, puking my guts up, damn near dead, and desperately wanting another drink. You see, this explains that to me. Now, if it never got any better, I can probably learn to live with that situation. But you and I know not only do we have an illness, we have a progressive illness. It always gets worse, never better. Probably for 2 reasons. Number one, first, today they know that acetone is a destroyer of human tissue. The more you drink, the longer you drink, the more tissue you destroy. Today they know that the organs of the body that produce the enzymes necessary to metabolize alcohol are the liver and the pancreas. They also know that that's the first organs of the body that the acetone attacks. And as they are being destroyed, the enzyme production becomes less and less. The craving becomes harder and harder. The drinking becomes harder and harder. So we're in the grips of a progressive illness because of the damage to the body. Also, probably the aging factor has something to do with this. As we get older, we know that the body begins to shut down on the production of everything. You know, I wish that were not true, but believe me, it is. I'm beginning to experience a lot of that. If I would take a drink now after 20-some-odd years of sobriety, I wouldn't start where I left off. The craving would be much, much harder. The drinking would be much, much harder. And the result of trouble is much, much more deep than it would have been the other way. How do I know that? I run my survey in AA. When I see one of us after several years of sobriety go to get drunk, man, I just can't, I can hardly wait to get to them and say, tell me about it. Is it better this time or is it worse? And I've never had one yet say it was better. Always. It's 10 times as bad as it was before. So we're in the grips of a progressive illness due to two things. Damage to the body and to the aging factor. Silky gave us that. I think we're the luckiest people in the world. We live in the century when they found out what alcoholism is. Nobody had ever found this out before. Thank God for Silkworth. Thank God for the work that's been done since then. Today, I know why I cannot successfully drink. Now, if I don't drink, then my problem's over with right here. If I don't put it in my body, this can't happen to me. So the fact that I'm allergic to alcohol, it's extremely important for me to understand that's why I can't drink. But it's also beside the point. Because if I don't drink, this can't happen. So all I got to do to control my allergy is just don't drink. Isn't that simple? Now, I know a guy who is allergic to fish. And as long as he don't eat fish, though, he's okay. But every time he eats fish, his throat swells up, he goes to the hospital, and he almost dies. Now, his real problem is not the fact that he's allergic to fish. There's something in his head that doesn't work right when it comes to fish. There's a light bulb doesn't turn on, there's a switch that doesn't connect, or something. Because left on his own resources, from time to time, his mind tells him that it's okay to eat fish. And he'll eat the fish, and he goes right back in the hospital. And I bet it nearly always starts like this. Well, I haven't had any fish in 90 days. Surely I could have one piece of fish. There's probably that halibut I've been eating. If I'd eat nothing but rock cod, I'd be okay. Or it might even say it's them damn people I've been eating fish with if I just change my crowd. Whatever the reason, his mind gives him permission. Left on my own resources, I'm the same way when it comes to alcohol. Left on my own resources, my mind always tells me it's okay to drink. And I take a drink, and then I trigger the allergy, and then I can't stop. So my real problem is not the fact that I'm allergic to alcohol. It's the fact that I can't keep from taking the first drink. And my book is going to emphasize that over and over, that the real problem lies in the mind telling us we can drink rather than in the body that ensures that we can't drink. Silky understood us quite well. Now he's going to show us a little bit about the mental side, and then we're going to have some dinner.
Okay, finishing up down there, he said our only relief we suggest is entire abstinence. And we hear always talking about abstinence in the body. You know, an abstinence in the body is a problem in of the mind, not the body. That can only be done in the mind. Because the first drink comes from the mind. He begins to describe how this happens on Roman numeral, we'll back up a page, 26.
Roman numeral 26, last paragraph.
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. This is why we drink.
Now, a lot of people, a lot of alcoholics are highly offended when you say that to them. They say, oh, no, 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 that's not the reason I drank. They say, I drank because I love the taste of alcohol. Well, I wouldn't argue with them whether they do or not. You know, I love the taste of cold beer. Always have, all my life, as far back as I can remember. Also love the taste of Cold Mountain spring water. And I never did sit down and drink a case of Cold Mountain spring water. That cold beer did something for me that spring water doesn't do. As a kid growing up, I was always on the outside of the crowd looking in. I always wanted to be a part of, knew I could not be. Always knew that whatever I said, whatever I did would be wrong. People would laugh. I would be embarrassed. You girls, I couldn't even get around you. I was just absolutely tongue-tied. And one night somebody gave me a drink of moonshine whiskey. And all of those feelings disappeared. And I was allowed to ask a girl to dance with me. I was allowed to take her home from a dance. I was allowed to get in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet with her. And I was allowed to do some things I'd been wanting to do for a long, long time. I loved the effect alcohol had upon me. Now, if it gave me a slightly tipsy, out-of-control, nauseous feeling, I wouldn't love that. But you see, it gives me an exciting, in-control feeling. Entirely different than what it gives them.
The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You know, this becomes normal to us. Then he describes how we drink. Just before we drink, he says, they are restless, irritable, and discontented.
Let's add a few more words. We're filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse associated with the things we did on the last drunk. We're sober, but we don't feel good, and we want to feel better.
Unless they can again experience the sense and ease and comfort we come at once by taking a few drinks.
The mind begins to think about a great, exciting, in-control feeling that comes from the first two drinks and says, man, if I had a couple of drinks, I'd feel better. And that thought gets so strong that it pushes out all thoughts to the contrary, and we forget the jailhouses. We forget the divorce courts and the hospitals. We concentrate only on what the first two drinks will do for us, not what 20 drinks will do to us. And after a while, we begin to believe we can drink. After all, we see other people drinking.
That's right.
And the book says they're drinking with impunity, then why can't I? And the next thing you know,
after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do,
after I succumb to the desire and take a drink and put it in the body,
the phenomenon of craving develops.
Now then, it's no longer a mental problem, now it's physical.
They pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change in the mind, there is very little hope for his recovery. He leaves the body and he goes to, we're going to recover in the mind. Total absence is recovery in the mind. So he is describing here what is taking place in the mind. Okay. If we
we having a little consultation, I guess you know.
Okay. I don't know. As we we can summarize this side. We have the physical allergy. We can't safely drink without producing a phenomenal craving. So we'll summarize that. So the main problem would be in the mind. And looking over here, we know we described this. He said we're restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, the human being, we are God's greatest creation. I just marvel at to see how we are running around the world to see everything else, and we are God's greatest creation. Individually, there's nothing as complicated on the face of this earth as the human body and the human mind. God didn't make anything more miraculous than that on the face of this earth. We have very complicated bodies. And our minds are the greatest thing God had ever made on the face of this earth. We all have emotions. Emotions are a part of life. Living is very complex. All these God-given things that God has given us to make us complete humans, these things get out of control. All people have problems with this. All people have emotional problems. No one has ever been perfect, and no one has cornered the market on this. All human beings have problems with in their lives, and all have problems with emotions. And these things build up on people as the pressure points. These things build up on people, and at a certain point, they express with all sort of behavior. You know, we have all kinds of human problems. They all come out of the same areas. But the alcoholic to be, he has these problems that build up on him, and sometimes a child, it says, talks about his first experience the same way with me. While having one of these emotional problems, I was exposed to alcohol. I took a few drinks. Some people do it the first time they drink. Some people drink for quite a few years before they discover that. But it happened that I took a few drinks, and I noticed that when I took a few drinks, I found a sense of ease and comfort that came at once by taking a few drinks.
Stimulating effect takes over.
That's right. And I felt better or different as a result of these drinks. So I had had this little problem maturing and growing up and handling things, and it had become quite a problem with me. So when I discovered a few drinks, the few drinks became my solution. So my problem now had a solution. Now, when a human mind has a problem, fine gadget, and it finds a solution, it has the tendency to remember that solution. So the next time you have the problem, it can refeed you what you learned before. You know, we remember success. That's the way we. Mental addiction. Add together means to remember success. Now, chances are, if you go to the same barbershop or the same beauty shop or the same store, you buy the same products. You buy that product, you remember when you go to the store, you just go automatically buy it again. You repeat success. And what's happened, we become restive, irritable, and discontent. We take a few drinks, we get a sense of ease and comfort. It comes back and depresses our emotional level, and we remember that. Yeah. So the next time I become restless, irritable, and discontent, my mind remembers what I did the last time. It thinks about a few drinks. And that obsession, that's an idea to get that relief, an idea to get that sense and ease and comfort. And that idea is so strong, it overcomes all other ideas. When I think about how great a few drinks is going to make me feel, I can't even remember getting a DWI 3 weeks ago. But my mind is thinking about the great feeling I'm going to get, right? The mind can't retain but one predominant idea at a time. And the idea to drink pushes out all other ideas. That's just what's so strange about the mind of the alcoholic. And this obsession to drink always says, it's so nice. My obsession was so nice. It always said, let's have a few drinks. It never did say, let's go get a DUI or nothing like that. It just, it always said, you know, we ain't going to have but a few. Okay, and when I build up to a certain point, I remember my problem comes back, I remember my solution, I reach over and take a few drinks, that's my solution. It does depress my emotions.
Stimulation.
Yeah, but it comes over here. The main problem is triggers my body. Once I put the alcohol into my system, my body chemistry doesn't work right and develops a craving. And I got now the body's taking over. It's not the mind, it's the body. And the craving demands another drink and another drink and another drink. I go through the well-known spree, and down here at the bottom, we repeat our alcoholic national anthem. I will never do that again. And we really mean it down here. And as we come up for air, you know, we're remorseful. You know, over what has happened. We're restless, irritable, and discontented. And we go around for a few weeks, we get bored. What makes us restless, irritable, and discontented? Not great big problems. Everyday living, stopping for gas in the morning, on the way to work, ringing a time clock, burning a toast. Things that happen to people every day which we can't escape make us restless, irritable, and discontented. We build up to that point again. When we reach that tolerance level, and all two of us have the same tolerance level, or two of us have the same pattern. When we reach that point, we remember the sense and ease and comfort to come at once by taking a few drinks. Reach over and take a few drinks, we feel better, but it sets off a nominal craving. We go through the well-known spree. Dr. Silkworth said this vicious cycle is repeated over and over again.
We got the mind triggering the body. Because the more the mind makes us take a drink, if we put alcohol into our system, the chemical deficiency gets worse. As the chemical deficiency gets worse, the craving gets stronger. As the craving gets stronger, the drinking gets harder. As the drinking gets harder, more emotional problems we got over here to trigger it back. So the mind is destroying the body, and the body in reverse is destroying the mind. We can't drink because of the allergy. We can't quit because of obsession. Therefore, we are powerless over alcohol. Now, once we see the problem, and this is what Dr. Silkworth gave us, we find out, I love this statement. Someone wrote that during the war, made a statement in a plane or something somewhere. It says, we find the solution is simple once we understand the problem. And this is really a profound statement. It's simple. There is a weakness here. Yeah.
Now, in our illness of ignorance,
yeah,
before coming to AA, before the doctor's opinion,
yeah,
we see the solution as one of two things.
Yeah, controlling it.
First, we all try to control our drinking while drinking.
Yeah, I tried that.
One or two drinks, and then we're going to quit.
Yeah.
Any of you ever try that in here in this room today? Control our drinking?
It's hard to control your drinking while drinking.
Now then we see...
Okay.
Now then we see that why it's impossible to control our drinking while drinking.
That's
because
right.
of the allergy. We try that for a few years, and then we say, well, by golly, we'll just quit drinking.
That's right. I tried 13 years to control my drinking while drinking. And then I finally decided, well, you just can't drink, so quit. So I went over on the quitting side. I found out I was worse at quitting than I was with drinking. I found out that drinking was not my problem. Quitting was not my problem. Starting was my problem. I could quit, but I couldn't stop starting. Starting was my problem. Okay. So when I decided to quit, when an alcoholic means business, he gets our willpower. We got plenty of that. So I got old Will out and put him right in there. I said, sick him, Will. I'm through with that drinking. I blocked out the obsession for 9 solid months with willpower. I was miserable, but I just wouldn't take a drink. Finally, the obsession would come at me constantly. One day, one of them got over, and I was gone again. So you can't be successful with blockage in here with will, nor can you control the amount you take. But that is not where we're going to defeat this. We're going to defeat it right in here. Not over here, but right in here. If we could make some personality changes in our makeup, if we could live below this line where it's necessary, if we could just make a few changes and live below this line, we would never find it necessary to take a drink. We would never experience the obsession. Therefore, we would never take the first drink, and the allergy would never hurt us. This is what we are proposing as the solution. The solution is in our personality change, sufficient to recover. Power greater than ourselves, restore us to sanity. Just small changes, good enough to recover. Now, once we see the problem there, we can find where we can defeat this. And this is what Dr. Silkworth gave us, this information. And then we will be able to develop a solution and a plan to bring this about. And this way, millions of us have recovered.
So it's quite easy to see as we look at that picture that if you can't successfully drink because of the allergy, if you can't successfully quit because of the obsession of the mind, then you've become absolutely powerless over alcohol. For the first time, I see what my problem really is. Now, since they can't do anything about the allergy, then recovery has to come through the mind. And Dr. Silkworth said, this is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And the word psychic takes us straight to the mind. And our psychic is made up by the way we think, the way we feel, our attitude and outlook upon life, people, places, and things in general. And let's face it, when we're sober, before AA, we were just not very happy people. We were restless, we were irritable, we were discontented, full of shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. That leads to rage, anger, worry, depression, and etc. Now, if we're to recover, he says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, once we can throw out some old ideas and develop some new ideas, then maybe we can find a way to live where we can be not only sober, but peaceful, happy, and free. The very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he's very despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. So he gives us the solution as a psychic change, a change in mental attitudes. Now that's brought about through the program of action in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not brought about through going to meetings. Going to meetings might keep us sober, but recovery, the changes necessary to be able to maintain happy sobriety, comes about through the program of recovery. So our book will deal not with sobriety, but with recovery from that hopeless condition of the mind and body known as alcoholism. That's all we've got for this afternoon. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you later this evening. Don probably has an announcement.
Yeah, I'm going to start out again tonight with a little story, a little joke. I kind of love to tell them, as you can tell. Do we have any Al-Anons in the room? Do we have any Al-Anons this weekend?
Okay.
This one is going to be about an Al-Anon. And we told them before about the alcoholic, so it's the Al-Anon's turn. And what it's about really is an alcoholic and an Al-Anon and an Al-Ateen. And they had all been to a convention somewhere, an AA convention, and on the way home they decided to take a shortcut through the country and see a little of the scenery. Well, sure enough, they managed to get themselves lost and couldn't find their way out, and it's getting pretty dark, and they finally run into an old farmer's house, and they go up and knock on the door and ask him for directions on how to get out of there. And he said, well, I can tell you how to get out of here, that's no problem. He said, it's getting so dark, you're probably going to get lost again. And he said, why don't you just spend the night? And then in the morning, you can get up after daylight and go home. And they said, well, oh, yeah, that's great, that's fine. And the farmer said, but there's only one catch to it. He said, I can only sleep two of you in the house. One of you will have to sleep down in the barn with the animals. And the little Alateen, he said, oh, let me sleep down there. He said, I love animals, and they love me, and that won't be any problem at all. So they all said, okay, and they all go to bed, and little Alateen down the barn, and in about an hour, there's a knock on the front door. And the farmer, he goes to the door, and there stands little Alateen. He said, man, I can't sleep down there. He said, the chickens are clucking, and the cows are mewing, and the horses are stomping their feet, and the pigs are grunting, and he said, I just can't sleep. And the alcoholic said, well, that's all right, son, come on in. He said, hell, I was raised on a farm. I understand animals, they understand me, I'll go down there and sleep. So they all go to bed, the alcoholic down in the barn, and sure enough, in about an hour, knock on the door, and the farmer goes to the door, and there stands the alcoholic. He said, man, I can't sleep down there either. He said, those chickens are clucking, and those pigs are grunting, and the cows are mooing, and the horses are stomping their feet. I just can't sleep. And the Al-Anon said, well, all right. I knew it would be up to me to take care of the situation. You boys go to bed, and I'll sleep in the barn. So they all said, okay, and she goes down the barn, goes to sleep. Sure enough, about an hour, there's a knock on the door, and the farmer goes to the door, and there stands the pigs and the cows and the chickens. we love Al-Anon. We're both married to black belt Al-Anons, and we really do think that that's one of the better things that's happened to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is the Fellowship of Al-Anon. We appreciate you. We love you. We really do. Love to make jokes, too.
Okay, my name is Joe. I'm a real alcoholic.
Joe.
As we completed Doctor's opinion, we basically looked at step one, what is the problem, the information of Dr. Silkworth. He gave us information of the problem in which we can use to make a diagnosis, a self-diagnosis, and determine whether we are alcoholics or powerless over alcohol, when our lives have become unmanageable. Now, once we have completed the doctor's opinion, we now come to Bill's story. And we're looking at the chapters. We're looking at the textbook. And a textbook is a book that gives you information. And the key thing about a textbook is not only it gives you information, it gives you that information in a sequence. And very important is the sequence of the information. And we say this is a program, and we sometimes use that word very lightly. But a program is a sequence of events that lead to a conclusion. And this is a sequence of events. Now that he's told us what the problem is, now we have Bill's story. And once a great teaching book, once it teaches you something, then it gives you some additional information to bring out that point. Now that we understand the problem, we're going to look at Bill's story, which is a classic example of the problem. This is an example of the problem. We can see that Bill, and as we read Bill's story, we're going to see that Bill was powerless over alcohol and that his life had become unmanageable. I always say it's like going to medical school. I imagine I've never been there. But if they were going to teach you about a particular disease, they would take you in the classroom and teach you all about this disease. And then after you learn it in an academic fashion, then they take you out in the ward and show you someone who has this particular illness. And this is what Bill's story does. We actually see a person with alcoholism. Also, it's along the lines of what they were doing, remember, in 1935. 34, 30. When they went to a new person, they would sit down and tell him their story. They would tell, as they told his story, then they could identify his problem through listening to their story. Back before the book was written in the Oxford groups, they called this, it wasn't any 12 steps weren't written at that time, they called this a visit. And they would say, can we make a, and they would come to your home or in the hospital or wherever you were, and they would make a visit on you. Now on this visit, they would start off by telling you their story. And once they completely convinced you that you were an alcoholic, then they would say, can we come back in a few days on a second visit? And on the second visit, they would talk about their solution. The spiritual experience. And they would see if this person believed in God. And once they accomplished these two visits, if they were satisfied, they would then invite you to the Oxford group meeting. Now remember, the Oxford group meeting didn't have anything to do with alcoholism. So that information had to be imparted before you went to the meeting. And when you got to the Oxford group meeting, you made your decision. That was step three, was their first step. So one and two had to be done outside the meeting. Now Bill is doing the same thing with the book now. He's laying the preparation for the program. He's going to give us those information, steps one and two, with the first four chapters and the doctor's opinion. So this is where we now come to the sequence of the book. Now that we understand the problem, let's look at an example of it in Bill's story.
When it came time to write the book, they knew that they wouldn't be able to see the first person in California and sit down with them and make the standard visit. So the big book had to be complete enough to do that job for them. One alcoholic identifying with another, like Bill did with Bob, and like Bill and Bob did with Bill with Bill Dodson. So they decided to take Bill's story and put it here in the book. One alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic,
making the standard Oxford group visit, or what we would call today a 12-step call.
Yeah.
Now, as we read this thing, if we can identify with Bill Wilson, we'll be able to see the beginning of his alcoholism. We'll be able to see when it was fun drinking for him. We'll be able to see that changing to drinking through absolute necessity. And then we're going to be able to see the progression to where he's drinking for the sickest reason of all, complete absolute oblivion. And a lot of people say, well, we can't identify with Bill because after all, he was a night school lawyer and we were not. New York City stock speculator and we were not. And many of the ladies say we can't identify with him because he's a man. And I thought for a long time he was an old man. And I find out that when he wrote the big book, he was still in his 30s, when he was writing on the big book, 30s and into the 40s. So if we look at this thing and look for identification, I think all of us are going to be able to identify with Bill in the way he felt, the way he thought, the things he did, and surely how he drank. And if we can identify with him, bearing in mind that we're the new person, this is the first contact we've had, and if we can identify with him, then we'll be able to see him recover from alcoholism. And we can begin to believe if he could do it, we're enough like him, that just maybe we could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope. Today, you and I have got plenty of people to talk to. In those days, they didn't. The first guy in California, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, they had to get their identification through the book. And Bill's story fits in here in exact sequence, bearing that in mind. Let's go to page 2 and let's briefly run through Bill's story. I think another thing we're going to see is we'll be able to see Bill when he recovered, and we'll be able to see him apply the tenets of the Oxford group, and we'll really be able to see the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as we go through Bill's story. We'll try to point them out as we go through.
Begin on page 2. He said, I took a night law course and attained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I had proved to the world I was important.
I already identified with Bill Wilson. That's all I ever wanted to do, was succeed at something, try to prove to the world that I'm important also. That seems to be a characteristic of all we alcoholics, trying to prove to them that we're just as good as they are.
My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost none money, but some became rich. Why not I? I studied economics, business, as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think aright. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it did disturb my wife. We had long talks when I was still her foreboding by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk.
I have no trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. I think they call this selling fast talking to slow thinking people. He was trying a little of it on Lois, so she didn't always buy into that either.
Okay, by the time I completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. Now, Bill, we see, started off going to law school, and then he was fooling around with the market and got into the excitement of Wall Street. Then he decides law is not for him. So the inviting mainstream of Wall Street had me in his grips. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this outlaw of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge a weapon that one day would turn to flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I might imagine that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. And Bill, at this time, got involved with Wall Street. At this time, you know, I guess Wall Street was unregulated like it is today. There's a lot of speculation going on, and people were making money, and the market was good, and everybody was making money. And Bill said, "This is not going to last long." So he got the idea. You know how alcoholics are; they're always coming up with ideas. Bill came and got a, Bill looked at this and he got the idea. He said, we ought to quit investing on speculation. We should go out and investigate these companies, look into the background of them, and invest more on information. He said, I think we could make more money and be more successful.